Even now, after more than 15 years, it's hard to see the invasion of Iraq through the gaze of history. Most of the major players in that decision are still with us, and few are not haunted by it. New York Times contributor and author Robert Draper talked to most of the key officials involved to revisit their roles, among them Powell, Rice, Wolfowitz, Tenet, Bremer, Fleischer. He interviewed dozens who worked in the Departments of State, Defense, and the National Security Council and the intelligence community, as well as reporters who fumbled or challenged the story at the time. The result is the new book, To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Robert Draper to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
All right. So what got you thinking and wanting to explore, and certainly to this level of detail, the war in Iraq?
Well, I guess two or three things all at once. I mean, one is that I feel like the war's legacy is still with us, not only in terms of the Middle East, but also in terms of our own politics. Obama's presidency was enabled by his being an anti-war candidate. You could argue that Trump's presidency was enabled not just because of Obama, but because he had distinguished himself in the Republican primary as the man who didn't have the experience the others did politically, and that was for the better, because after all, experts like them led us to these endless wars. It's also just that frankly, I thought there were some fundamental riddles to this legacy-defining moment in the Bush presidency that had never been answered, including by me. And those were the very basic ones, which is, why did he decide to do it? When did he decide to do it? Could anyone or anything have talked him out of it? Did the intelligence ultimately matter, and thus could better intelligence have mattered? So I set out to do this book knowing, or hoping at least, with the passage of time, that I would be able to gain insights from people who didn't feel as constrained from being in the heat of the moment to talk about it. And I do think that phenomenon was borne out, that I, particularly in the intelligence community, got a lot of folks who talked to me who were inside the CIA at the time and were unable to speak to the press of them.
You use the word phenomenon. That's interesting to me because it really, by all accounts, this plan shouldn't have worked, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's hard. I mean, there are lots of people to this day who will say, well, you know, if only the Bush administration hadn't flubbed the invasion, if only they had had more people on the ground, if only they had thought up a better post-war scheme, then things would be fine. I don't think any of the evidence suggests that. I mean, start with the fact that it was, at minimum, a change of subject after being attacked on 9/11. Saddam had nothing whatsoever to do with that attack, and the notion, which was pushed by the Bush administration, including the president at the time, that Saddam would confederate with al-Qaeda, hand over his weapons to al-Qaeda, was factually hamstrung by the reality that, number one, he had no weapons to hand over, and number two, he had no relationship with al-Qaeda. So essentially, to wage an unjustified war would have inevitably been not only ill-advised, but would have led to tragic consequences.
So if we were in a criminal court, the question that would come up very quickly, as it did during the debate, is where's the motive? What is the motive, then, to go to war?
Sure. Yeah. And look, I think the sincere motive by President Bush, I know there's people who believe he did it for war or for oil, or he did it to avenge his, you know, the attempted assassination on his father. I did not find any evidence to really support those cases. I think that he genuinely wanted to protect Americans from what he believed was going to be a second wave after 9/11, something for which he was ill prepared. And he fell back, I think, on what he knew, on the familiar, which was the evil of Saddam Hussein. And look, let's not sugarcoat it. I mean, Saddam was a terrible dictator who was terrible to his people. That is not the same thing as him being a threat to the U.S. And, you know, not only had Saddam not ever said that he wished to do harm to the American homeland, but in fact, as my book discloses, less than 2 weeks after 9/11, his right-hand man, Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, sent a couple of letters that made their way to the State Department, in which he was basically extending an olive branch to the Bush administration, saying, we, the Iraqi regime, want to be your ally in the war on terror. You know, sorry my boss said some churlish things after 9/11, but, you know, he was playing to his base, but we feel like we're natural allies. We hate al-Qaeda. They've tried to assassinate us, too. And, of course, that went unheeded.
I read quite a litany of people that you interviewed for this book, a partial list, of course. And it seems to me, and I don't, this is just a guess on my part, but maybe the one that got away that you would have loved to have talked to would have been Dick Cheney.
The most of the, yes.
Yeah.
So the three I was unable to talk to were President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and Secretary Rumsfeld. Secretary Rumsfeld is his health has been in decline, and so he would not have been able to speak regardless of his, you know, inclinations or disinclinations. Vice President Cheney was on the fence, and I, through an intermediary, you know, had kind of a back and forth, and ultimately he decided not to cooperate. I regret that because up to a point, I think the vice president was very intellectually honest in prosecuting his case that that rested on two things. First, that after 9/11, we needed to project force in the Middle East to show people that we meant business, because historically, in Cheney's view, our failure to do so after the U.S. embassy attacks in Africa in 1998, after the coal attack off the coast of Yemen in 2000, that people weren't taking us seriously anymore, that they figured they could do things to us and get away with it. And his additional concern was that the next wave would involve chemical or biological weapons, and he believed a rogue actor like Saddam might give them. And so he'd be interesting to talk to on that subject, but the problem was by August of 2002, Cheney had just abandoned any pretense of sticking to the actual facts and started saying, simply stated, there can be no doubt Saddam's got weapons of mass destruction, when in fact there was plenty of doubt about that. And I would have loved to have talked to him about, you know, how he came to be so certain, or if he was just trying to be the ultimate salesman. Finally, Bush I wasn't able to talk to. I would have been happy to do so. He had not liked my previous book on him, thought it was unfair, though I disagree. And but I also think that President Bush has shown a disinclination to baring his soul relating to Iraq, and I wouldn't expect him to do so to a reporter.
Back to Vice President Cheney for a moment. You make the point that Cheney really thought, and just dismissed this idea of intel. You didn't really need it because we would go there, we'd find the weapons, and that's all that would matter.
That's right. I think that all the rest was details. It didn't matter whether you believe the case by this Iraqi defector named, you know, codenamed Curveball, that Saddam had these mobile biological labs that created biological weapons. It sounded good to Cheney, but even if it wasn't true, we'd go in, we'd find some weapons, and nobody would be there with a spreadsheet saying, these weapons couldn't form to that particular tip. And look, there are a lot of people who believe that. The CIA had that view, too. I mean, I think Tenet's basic view was, we're going to find weapons, and so war is inevitable anyway. We might as well do what we can to be supportive of the president and to find the weapons once we invade.
Given that so many, as I mentioned in the introduction, so many of the people are still with us and they're involved, and I also said in the introduction that, and could you get the sense in the book, that many of them are haunted by the decision, as are politicians who are still dealing with the ramifications of their votes. So what was it about that particular, in talking to the people, that they are haunted by, of that? And is that different than a gut-wrenching regret?
Yeah, no. I think that an even sharper distinction needs to be made between those people who indicate, being haunted by it and even feeling a certain remorse about it, and having learned any lessons from it. Right? I mean, it's the Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, who is a key player in all of this, who is, besides Bush, the main character in my narrative. The book begins with him and ends with him, and who really was the person who managed to push the subject of going after Iraq after 9/11 on the president's agenda. I think, you know, he's visited Arlington Cemetery a lot. He spent a lot of time at Walter Reed with the veterans, and these were real heartfelt encounters. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's crafted a whole list of if I had to do it over again, here's what I would do. I'd say that question, though, is even more salient when it comes to legislators, including, by the way, Vice President Joe Biden. And Biden voted to give Bush the authorization to use military force in Iraq, and his explanation later was that, well, I regret that, but I trusted President Bush to just use that as leverage to get weapons inspectors into Iraq, and never, you know, I didn't think he'd go to war with it. Well, come on, it's an authorization to use military force, and Biden hardly stands alone. He was one of a majority of senators who voted to give the president that authorization, but they did so believing, and Biden is among them, that Saddam had weapons. And so now that we know the intelligence was flawed, the question must be asked, why didn't these senators ask more probing questions? Some of them did, by the way. Senator Carl Levin, who was the chair of a House Armed Services Committee, and Senator Bob Graham, who was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, were both skeptics, and both of them voted against the war because they were the ones who knew the intelligence so intimately and therefore knew how flawed it was.
I want to just back up for a second, because you use in the book terms that I find interesting, which are in their imagination and their flights of fancy, that in the days, weeks, months that followed 9/11, this was like a freewheeling, that we went from this to suddenly Iraq, and then it became the laser focus. But that idea that the imagination is what brought them there is, it's not only frightening, but it is fascinating too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's actually something that going into this project had not occurred to me. I began to see it before my eyes in the reporting, but then I read this book by a British sociologist named Frank Ferretti, and he writes in great detail about how in moments such as the Iraq debacle that policymakers can become unhinged from the facts, owing to a bunch of different reasons, partly out of fear and unpreparedness. I mean, people in Washington felt themselves impregnable. We hadn't been attacked here since the British came at the beginning of the 19th century, and so suddenly the notion that invulnerable Washington could become very vulnerable really freaked out, to put it mildly, a lot of policymakers here. And then they fell back on their biases and began to gravitate towards information that confirmed those biases. Among the biases was that Saddam was, you know, a bad dude, and therefore would probably do something. He would be involved in whatever bad thing came next to America. It's been said that 9/11 was a failure of the imagination. I think it can now be said that Iraq was a failure of too much imagination, and there was not an honest pursuit of truth. It's certainly true on Capitol Hill, but it's definitely true in the Bush White House, and in particular with President Bush, who had no time really, I mean, right in front of him, right before his eyes, he would hear people disagree about whether, for example, this 9/11 hijacker, Mohammed Atta, had met with an Iraqi intelligence official in Prague. George Tenet said, nope, it doesn't appear to be true. Vice President Cheney said, yep, it's got to be true. And at no point did the president say, hey, can we get a consensus on this? Can we actually, this is like worthwhile, because if Saddam and Al-Qaeda are hooked up with each other, I want to know that. And if it's not true, I want to know that too. Instead, he seemed to have kind of made up his own mind that Saddam would like nothing better than to be in cahoots with people like Al-Qaeda, when he did not have an earnest debate about whether the intelligence guided him to that conclusion.
I thought it was interesting in your telling of the story about Bush, because, there were many that thought, and I'll add myself into that list, would look at his actions and say, well, how, ask the question, well, how involved was he really? He just seemed to have sort of a kind of a hands-off approach. The other people were running the ship. He would, you know, open the door every once in a while and say, how are things going? Shut it and go about his day. You talk about it in the book, that there's this caricature of Bush, that he himself has latched onto, that he could be this lazy cowboy that kind of did his thing. But you paint him to be more intellectually rigorous than that, and also that the but with that said, intellectually he did cut corners.
Yeah. No, that's right. I think the tragic paradox of Bush and thus of his presidency was that here we in fact had a very intelligent man. Anybody who had spent time with former President Bush one-on-one could attest to that he is expert at unraveling the logic, or a faulty paragraph in a speech or something. And no one would say this guy's a dummy. And yet Bush himself emphasizes, as you pointed out, how, well, I don't do nuance. I trust my gut. I'm a man who sleeps well at night because I know, I know where I stand on things. And the problem was that Bush, for all his intelligence, did tend to cut corners intellectually. And I was referencing before the battle of intelligence that was being waged right before his eyes, and Bush not seeming to care about it. For that matter, there was not one person who Condi Rice dragged into the Oval Office who was anti-war. The only people, as it turned out, who had a rigorous discussion, the only Americans, I should say, but a rigorous discussion with President Bush about the inadvisability of going to war turned out to be his 20-year-old twin daughters. And no one else, King Abdullah of Jordan and a few others, from other countries would say that, but Bush would basically be of the view that, okay, I understand your politics in your region, I understand you've got to say what you say, but, history has called us, we need to do this. I think it was a dereliction of National Security Advisor Condi Rice's duty in failing to bring dissenting voices into the White House. But let's be fair, that's ultimately the president's decision, too. And at no point did the president say, I wonder if we should bring in somebody who, may have a different point of view. For that matter, he never asked his war council, the National Security Council, let's all have a discussion on the advisability of going to war. They had tons of discussions about how to do it, what, might come after in terms of humanitarian crises and seizing the oil, et cetera, but none about the pros and cons. And Bush would later say, well, I didn't have that discussion because I knew where everyone stood. But knowing where everyone stood on the subject is not the same thing as trying to find out where they stood and ultimately then whose point of view seems to be a little bit, more on point. All of that is on the president, and all of that points to a kind of intellectual incuriosity that is a through line in his political career, and which obviously had, tremendously tragic consequences here.
The book is To Start a War, and as my final question to you as we wrap up, the other big question, of course, is to stop a war, and we haven't really figured that out yet, have we?
No, it's tough to do. I mean, once a war apparatus gains locomotion, it's really tough to stop it. When you have only an invasion plan and you've meticulously prepared it and you've already got troops stationed and you've got all this other infrastructure and you've done these basing rights and everything else with other countries, it becomes a force unto its own, all the more so when you develop the view, which the president and his team did, not without logic, that prosecuting an invasion, say, in the dead of summer, when it's so damn hot in Iraq, is really, really ill-advised. So they felt like the clock was kind of ticking on this. But the truth is that, there were diplomatic solutions, and there certainly were a lot of people who would have embraced those diplomatic solutions. But that's there was the president, as I disclose in my book, 9 days after 7 of 9/11, said to a bunch of religious leaders in the Oval Office, "I am having trouble containing my bloodlust." He was mirroring America in that sense, but it was incumbent upon him to do so, and his failure to do so is going to be integral to the presidential legacy.
Well, I think this is the best 500 pages of nonfiction I've read all year. It's really good stuff and great reporting. Robert Draper's new book is To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq. Robert, I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.